Okay, hi everybody. Happy Thanksgiving to the Thanksgiving celebrators. Almost happy Hanukkah. Let's get to our we're coming near the end of this series. So we are getting to the geula, to the redemption, which is a good thing, right? Except it doesn't quite happen. But there are attempts for it to happen. So what are we going to do? This is basically the companion piece to the class we did last time, right? Last time we talked about this enormous crisis in the Jewish world of the Spanish expulsion. Where did the Jews go? The growth of this very fascinating mystical society in Tzfat. Today we're going to talk about the repercussions of the same event, but kind of in a different direction. We're going to see some relatively modern attempts to change history, right? A very different approach in medieval Jewish history from, whatever happens is God's will, and we're going to just absorb what happens to, well, maybe we can change the course of history. So we're going to explore a couple of those things, particularly the Smicha controversy and the story of Dona Gracia Mendez, who Dona Gracia Nasi, who's a fascinating individual. We're going to be more or less in the same time period as last time, i.e., the 16th century. Spot is important, but we're not going to spend as much time there. We're going to be in Jerusalem, in Hebron, in Tiberias. And we're going to be talking about different focal points in those places. The picture is from a lookout above the Kinneret, which is called the Mitzpeh Dona Gracia, right? Dona Gracia's lookout point. As we're going to see, Dona Gracia is very connected to Tiberias, even though she never makes it there. But she's going to be the last piece of our story. First, we have many other things we want to talk about. Okay, so let's take a look again. Let's go back to our timeline. And again, we're going over some of the same ground, but we're going to try to look at a few different and important elements. Okay, one of the things we're going to see is that 15th and particularly the 16th century is very much a new world. Okay, there's a lot of, we're really entering what historians sometimes call the pre-modern era. And that means things are really changing, and we're going to be talking about those changes. So first of all, 1440, the printing press is invented, right? The Gutenberg press. That's a very huge change in the world, certainly in the world of literacy and of spreading ideas. Columbus discovering America, that's a pretty big one, right? Americans celebrating Thanksgiving today. But the discovery of the New World, okay, was it really the discovery? Obviously, the native peoples are there, right? The Vikings came earlier. But what's important here is we're talking about an opening of an entire continent to Europeans who had never heard of this. And this, of course, is going to have a huge impact eventually on Jewish history as well. Less so in the 16th century, a little bit, but less so, but it's certainly important. 1517, the Ottoman conquest of the land of Israel. We talked about the Ottomans last time and how big an impact they have and how they really encourage the Jews to come to their empire, and there is this feeling of, well, we have an opportunity to go to the land of Israel in this very important and fraught time period. Clearly, this is a signal that redemption is happening. In the Jewish world, the 16th century is a time that is rife with a lot of speculation about when is the Messiah going to come and how is the Messiah going to come, and a lot of mystical drama around that, as well as some false messiahs. And we're going to talk about two particularly important ones. And this is a little bit of a lead-in to next week, which is our last class, where we're going to talk about the ultimate false messiah, who of course is Shabtai Tzvi. All right, well, maybe Jesus is a little more ultimate, but we're going to talk about the in the more modern world. Okay, we're going to be in Jerusalem, so we want to know about Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. Very significant issue that we're going to talk about is the Smicha controversy, 1538 to 1539. We also want to talk about renewed Jewish community in Hebron, which is happening around the same time. And of course, the story of Dona Gracia and the Ancona affair is part of that story. Okay. But really, the 16th century is an opening to new worlds, both literally, as in the new world, right, to North America, South America, as well as figuratively. So we have the beginnings of the modern world, right? So we have a nice here on the very far left, you have a nice reproduction of the Gutenberg press. Okay. It's invented in 1440, but it really only becomes very widespread by the 1500s. It's really hard to downplay the impact that the printing press has on the modern world, right? Before this, if you had, I don't know, 10 manuscripts, 15 manuscripts, that was an enormous library because it was incredibly expensive to copy manuscripts. So you don't have books, you borrow books, you read books, maybe in the synagogue. It's not something that's a very common thing to have. Once you have a printing press, you can, everybody can read, right? There can be mass literacy. Books and ideas spread much faster, right? So, for example, we talked last time about Rabbi Yosef Karo and the Shulchan Aruch, right? This code that he writes, it spreads throughout the Jewish world incredibly rapidly. So books can spread, ideas can spread, and that's a very important thing. In the middle here, forgive my New York centrism. This is Columbus Circle in New York. There's a lot of statues of Columbus. Some of them have been pulled down in recent years in woke America, but Columbus is still pretty important. You might not like him. He was not very nice to the natives, but he's extremely important in terms of the discoveries and the new immigration and the new worlds that are opening up for settlement. Of course, we know that Columbus discovering America is not about going to discover America. It's about finding a better way to get the spices from India, because spice trade is very, very important to Europe, and they want to take away the monopoly which the Ottoman Empire holds. So you need to find a new route. But in finding that new route, they find a whole new world. Was Columbus Jewish? Perhaps. Was he, a converso? Was he a secret Jew? Really, we have no proof of that. There's speculations, but we do know that there were people on his ship, in particular his astronomer, David Zacuto, who were Jewish. And of course, the opening up of America is a huge step in Jewish history, right? Very, very important. And finally, and you might not think it's as important, but it does have some fascinating impacts. The picture here on the right, coffee. Hey, all you coffee lovers, coffee is a really significant leap forward in human history. Okay, it becomes popular in Yemen in the 15th century. It spreads to the Middle East, to the Ottoman Empire in the 16th century, and that's where we first have this idea of coffee houses. And that's why, by the way, this is from a coffee house, I think in Germany, if I'm remembering correctly. But you can see that who's getting the coffee here. This is very much a Turkish nobleman because this is where the coffee is coming from. So this whole idea of kind of coffee culture, which eventually spreads to the 17th century, in the 17th century to Europe. By the way, Jews are very involved both in bringing in coffee and in opening up the first coffee houses. And then that's, I think, a fascinating thing in and of itself, that they're very involved in this new industry and in bringing in this new commodity and not being scared about it, even though we have halachic questions about coffee. Why does it have an impact on the world? Because coffee houses, first of all, become places for gathering, for socializing, for spreading new ideas, right? A lot of intellectual ferment in coffee houses. Coffee also, some of you may know, keeps you awake, right? So whereas in up until pretty recently, people woke up with the sun, did their work, and when the sun went down, they went to sleep. When you have coffee, you can stay up late. And there was actually a fascinating article written years ago about, did coffee actually encourage the mystics of Sfat to have things like Tikkun Leil Shavuot, where you stay up all night learning, Tikkun Chatzot, where you get up in the middle of the night to pray for the rebuilding of Jerusalem, right? The fact that you're able to stay awake, that kind of changes, that can change history. So that's new things in the non-Jewish world, but that affect the Jewish world. And for Jews, this is also very much a time of upheaval. The sign is not from the time of the 16th century. Okay? But we do have a lot of thoughts about when is the Messiah coming and how can we bring the Messiah and how do we get the redemption to happen? We talked about that last week with Sfat, right? And the Ariz Kabbalah, which is all about bringing the redemption and the societies that are about mourning for the temple and helping to bring the redemption. But you also had people who took it a step further and who actually proclaimed themselves to be the Messiah. And the most famous pair in the 16th century are these two people. One is called David HaReuveni, and the other is Shlomo Molcho. David HaReuveni is There are others like him before him. He's one of these very interesting characters that show up from time to time in Europe. They are Jews who claim they have come from, whether it's beyond the Sambatyon River, or they come from the place of the lost 10 tribes, right? We have a few different stories like this. He comes in the early 16th century. He shows up in Venice in the 1520s, then he goes to Portugal. He claims that he is a descendant of King David. He claims to be the son and the brother of kings of tribes. He's a black man. He's short. He doesn't look like other Jews of the time. And he's exotic enough, and it seems charismatic enough, that he gets not only the Jewish community to kind of really be attracted to him, but he actually speaks to kings and he speaks to popes, and he wants to negotiate a treaty between the Christians and the Muslims to bring world peace. It seems kind of fantastic to us now that that could happen, but it happens. And people really believe that he is coming to bring some news to the world. And he is in Portugal, and there is a converso Jew, right? A Jew who had become a Christian, named Diego Pires, who hears him and who is so enchanted with him that he actually, first of all, he changes his name. He calls himself Shlomo Molcho. He does a Brit Milah on himself, okay? And he starts to learn Torah and to go and to preach about the redemption. And this is an account from a Jewish historian named Yosef HaKohen, who wrote a book called Emek HaBacha, all about martyrs and martyrology, of which unfortunately there were quite a few in Jewish history, and certainly in this period of Jewish history. And he's the one that we hear about Shlomo Molcho. He's our earliest source, right? So he says, soon there came out of Portugal a noble whose name was Shlomo Molcho. He was of those who had fled there in the days of the Inquisition. While he was still a youth, he served as one of the secretaries of the king. But when he saw David and Reuveni, the Lord touched his heart and returned to the Lord, the God of our ancestors, and was circumcised. Soon he became the wisest of men, arousing much wonder. He went to Italy and with great daring spoke of the divine law in the presence of kings. He became learned in the wisdom of Kabbalah. He preached to large audiences in Bologna and other places. Eventually, he kind of convinces himself, as well as some others, that he is the Messiah. That's kind of a step too far. He's imprisoned. He's taken out, to be burned as a Christian who has defied the Inquisition, has returned to his Judaism. He refuses to renounce his Judaism, and therefore that's why he's considered a martyr. He's burned at the stake. David Reuveni is imprisoned. It's less clear what his fate was, but not a good fate, right? But these are these messiahs who capture the imagination of the Jews and the non-Jews, which I think is the fascinating part of it, but do not come to a good end. So it's a little bit of a preview of what we're going to talk about next week with Shabtai Tzvi. Let's go to Jerusalem, because that's where our story of the Smicha controversy is going to be. One of the places that we're going to talk about is Jerusalem. So the beautiful walls around the Old City today, which many of us are familiar with, and this is the most beautiful part, which is the Damascus Gate, right, with these gorgeous crenellations. This is rebuilt by Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent in the 1530s, right? The walls of Jerusalem, of course, there always were walls, but they were knocked down. They were rebuilt. They were knocked down. They were rebuilt. Suleiman decides it's his project to rebuild the walls. Not only does he rebuild the walls, he does various other civic projects. He brings water to the city, right? This is a public water fountain, a Sabil, which is right above what's called today Sultan's Pool, right? The pool that he digs so that there's a reservoir of water. He creates bathhouses, he creates markets. So there's some economic growth that's happening in Jerusalem. The last years of the Mamluks, the city had really, really declined, and certainly the Jewish population was not doing well at all. And under Suleiman, things get somewhat better, but we're still doing much, much better in Sfat. So just to give you a little bit of numbers, right? In Suleiman's time, we have give or take 2,000 Jews in Jerusalem, and we actually have population surveys under the Ottomans, which is interesting, right? We're really heading more into the modern world. So you have about 2,000 Jews in Jerusalem, but you have about 5,000 Jews in Sfat. So getting a little better, a little more stable, a little bit more economic growth, but still not in an amazing place. The Jewish community, right? they're allowed back under the Mamluks after the disaster of the Crusades, but there's persecution. There's not much that's done for them. The Jews live on Mount Zion. They also live in the Jewish quarter of today. Up until the late 16th century, the main synagogue is what you see here, the Ramban Synagogue. Eventually, they're going to be forbidden from being in the Ramban Synagogue, and they're going to move to what we call today the four Sephardic shuls. Okay, we hear from travelers about markets, about bathhouses, how a lot is ruined, but some things are okay. So we have various travelers' accounts. I brought you one that's a little bit earlier, right? The end of the 15th century, but it's still useful for us. And this is Rabbi Ovadia Bartanura. Rabbi Ovadia Bartanura, Bartanura the place, not the wine, okay? But, you know, that's where the wine comes from. Rabbi Ovadia Bartanura is famous for his commentary on the Mishnah, right? He writes this very important commentary on the Mishnah. And towards the end of his life, he comes to live out his days in Jerusalem. And this is what he writes, right? Jerusalem, notwithstanding its destruction, right? And that's what everybody who writes in this 15th, 16th century, notwithstanding that there is destruction, but, right, contains four very beautiful long bazaars, such as I have never before seen at the foot of Zion. They have all dome-shaped roofs and contain wares of every kind. All the necessaries of life, meat, wine, olives, and sesame oil can be very cheap. The soil is excellent, but it is not possible to gain a living by any branch of industry, unless it be that of a shoemaker, weaver, or goldsmith, right? So the economy is not that thriving if you can't make a living except through these things. I have taken a house close to the synagogue. In the court where my house is, there are five inhabitants, all of them women, right? This is a fascinating thing. Up until really almost modern times, you have way more widows in Jerusalem, right? People will come to Jerusalem to live out like the very end of their lives, and women tend to live longer than men. The community likes widows because when they die, their assets tend to go to the community. So there are five inhabitants, all of them widow women, and he talks about who takes care of him, but then he has this nice quote at the end. All possible winds blow in Jerusalem. It is said that every wind before going to its destination comes to Jerusalem to prostrate itself before the Lord. Right? So a little bit of change of climate for Rabbi Ovadia Bartanura. But this is our Jewish community in Jerusalem, not so big, not quite as thriving as Tzfat, and somewhat more conservative than Tzfat. And I'm putting this out for you now because we're going to talk about the Smicha controversy, which is not only a personal controversy between two rabbis, Rabbi Yaakov Beirav and Rabbi Levi Ibn Chaviv, but it's also a civic controversy between Tzfat and kind of its outlook on life and Jerusalem and its outlook on life. And they're not really the same. So what's the idea here? Okay, so Rabbi Yaakov Beirav is a very prominent rabbi. He's born in Spain, as you can see, before the expulsion, 1475. With the expulsion, he leaves, he goes to North Africa, he becomes the chief rabbi of Fez, then he moves on to Egypt and to the land of Israel, and eventually he ends up in Tzfat. He's not only a very, very learned rabbi and scholar, okay, and a community leader, but he's also a very wealthy man. He's a trader in spices. He makes a very nice living. So you get a sense of somebody who's very learned, but who's also kind of powerful in the material world. And he comes up with this very interesting idea, right? There's a verse that says, Tzion b'mishpat tifadeh v'shaveh v'tzedakah. Zion will be redeemed with judgment. Okay, now realize that, again, we're talking about this community, many of whom are expellees from Spain, some of whom had been conversos, managed to get out, return to Judaism. They feel that the only way they can bring the Messiah is by doing a mass repentance as well as atonement. They've done things that require atonement, and atonement in Jewish law requires punishment. Who can give the punishment that they need to get, which is basically lashes, malkot? Only the Sanhedrin. Okay, so let's just take a step backwards. The Sanhedrin, the high court, the rabbis, right? We know that they exist in the time of the Second Temple. They exist afterwards. What happens to them? Okay, so essentially, it's a little bit murky. We don't know 100%, but sometime in the 5th century of the Common Era, the Nisi'ut, the patriarchate, is abolished, and we assume that the Sanhedrin is abolished as well. And when the Sanhedrin is abolished, smicha is ordination, right? Giving one rabbi, giving ordination to his student, that kind of is abolished as well, because the chain, which is meant to be Moses to Joshua, right? One teacher to the next generation, to the next generation, that chain is broken. So even though, of course, there are rabbis throughout Jewish history, they are not considered to be musmachim in the same way that the rabbis of the Sanhedrin were. Rabbi Yaakov Beirav comes along and says, we need a new Sanhedrin so that we can ultimately bring the redemption by convening, by giving the punishments that are necessary, by bringing about this atonement and this repentance. And it's a very radical idea. Okay. So he comes to Tzfat in 1538, suggests this idea. He has the rabbis, the Beit Din, the court of the rabbis of Tzfat, give him smicha, give him ordination. And only at that point do they send a message to the rabbis in Jerusalem saying, do you agree with this? Okay, which is maybe was not the order of things that they should have done it in. So we're going to get to the rabbis of Jerusalem in a minute. But first, let's understand, what are they basing this on, right? What are their sources? How are they allowing this to happen if we know that this chain has been broken? Okay, so they're basically basing themselves on Maimonides. But even Maimonides has two different, not exactly the same approaches, right? So let's read the English first, okay? This is the Rambam in the Mishnah Torah, right? In this code of law that he writes, right? And let's see what he says here. If there's only one judge in Eretz Yisrael who possesses smicha, right? And note that it's in the land of Israel, and he's going to emphasize that in the other source as well. It has to be in the land of Israel. He should call two other judges to sit with him, and they should convey smicha on 70 judges at one time or one after the other. So you've got one who already has an authentic smicha. If you have one, you can have more. Afterwards, he and these 70 should join together to make up the Supreme Sanhedrin and grant smicha to others to make up other courts. It appears to me that if all the wise men in Eretz Israel agree to appoint judges and convey smicha upon them, the smicha is binding. And if so, and these judges may adjudicate cases involving financial penalties and convey smicha upon others. So here he's taking a step further, right? He's saying, you don't only need one who already has smicha. If all of the wise men of the land of Israel agree, then you can have smicha from the beginning. If so, why did the sages suffer anguish over the institution of smicha so that the judgment of cases involving financial penalties would not be nullified among the Jewish people? Because the Jewish people were dispersed and it is impossible that all could agree, right? That Rambam, he knows the Jews. Very difficult for everybody to come to an agreement, and Jews are living all over. If, by contrast, there was a person who had received smicha from a person who received smicha, he does not require the consent of all the others. Indeed, he may adjudicate cases involving financial penalties for everyone, for he receives smicha from a court. The question whether smicha can be renewed requires resolution. So the Rambam kind of leaves it open-ended, saying, well, if you have someone who has real smicha, which we don't, or you have all of the sages of the land of Israel who can agree, right? And it seems you also need a majority of the Jews in the land of Israel, then you can do it. If not, not so clear. Okay, so that's what he says in the Mishnah Torah. In his commentary to the Mishnah, I apologize, I didn't have it in Hebrew, in English, but we'll read it and we'll translate it. He's more definite, right? Listen to what he says. But Ani Savor, and I think, She'em ha'ita haskama mitol kol ha'tamidim v'chachamim limanot ish b'yeshiva. If all of the sages agree, right? And again, all of the sages have to agree. Klomar she'yasuhu rosh, they appoint one person to be in charge. U'bitznai she'yeheze be'eretz Yisrael, and it has to be in the land of Israel, k'mo she'ikdamnu, as we said before. Harei oto ha'ish titkayem lo ha'yeshiva. And this one can be, get smicha and give smicha to others. Because if you don't say that, you can never have a Sanhedrin again. You have to have somebody, you have to have a first one. God promised us our judges are going to come back. B'shama tomar, shamashiach yimne otam. Maybe the Messiah is going to come and appoint them. Ba'afal pisha einam smuchim. Harei ze muchkash. This can't be true. Lefisha kfar be'arnu b'haktamat sifreinu zeh. Shamashiach lo yosif b'torah v'lo yigra mimenu. Lo b'torah shebichtav v'lo b'torah shebaalpeh. The Messiah is not going to change the Torah. Ba'ani savur, and I think, says the Rambam, shasanhedrin tashuv lifnei hitgalut hamashiach. I believe the Sanhedrin is going to return before the Messiah comes. The Zeiyeh Misimanav. This is going to be one of the signs that the Messiah is going to return, that we're going to start the smicha again. And here he seems much more definite. If you could get all the sages to agree, right, and you could do this, then you can create this new institution, renewed institution of the Sanhedrin, and this is a sign the Messiah is going to come. So if you're following the Perush HaMishnah, seems like you have a pretty good basis to start, as long as you can get everyone to agree. Mishnah Torah, a little less clear. But either way, you have to get everyone to agree. So they write a letter to Jerusalem, the sages of Jerusalem. The sage of Jerusalem, the person who's the most important, is Rabbi Levi ibn Chabib, who's almost exactly the same dates as Rabbi Yaakov Beirav. He has a similar, although not exactly the same, trajectory. He's born in Spain, go to Portugal. From there, he goes to Salonika, and he comes to Jerusalem in 1525. And he becomes the undisputed leader of the teachers and the rabbis of Jerusalem. He's very connected to the conversos, to the anusim. In fact, he has a famous psak, a famous halachic decision, where he says a woman who is married to a Jew who is forced to convert and is kind of trapped wherever he is and can't get out, she is not an aguna, she can remarry. He is considered as if he's not her husband anymore, which is a very revolutionary decision and freed a lot of women. He's also very connected to Jerusalem. And this is how he would sign his documents, right, is what you have here. Yoshev Yerushalayim, a settler in Jerusalem, ne'enach b'shivron motnaim, sighing with the brokenness of his body, ki yir'ech urbat beit mikdashah saviv, because he sees the destruction of the temple all around him, se'ir halomdim hachonim lifnei hamishkan saviv, the youngest of the students who are encamped around the tabernacle. Okay, so he, Rabbi Levi ibn Chabib, his father is Rabbi Yaakov ibn Chabib, who writes the Ein Yaakov. Right, he's a very learned man. He hears Rabbi Yaakov's Beirav's arguments. He reads what the Rambam says. He likes the idea, but he's not 100% convinced. And he thinks about it for 2 weeks. And after 2 weeks, he sends a letter back and he says, it's a very beautiful idea, but no. I can't agree to it, and I don't give you my permission, and therefore it would seem the story would be over, right? We said the majority or the totality of the rabbis of the land of Israel have to agree, and Rabbi Levi ibn Chabib, who's definitely one of the great rabbis, represents the community of Jerusalem, he doesn't agree. Rabbi Yaakov Beirav continues anyway, right? And he gives smicha to students, and he kind of ignores Rabbi Levi ibn Chabib. He doesn't ignore him. He actually writes against his opinion. Rabbi Levi ibn Chabib writes back against his opinion, right? It goes back and forth, each one against the other. At some point, it kind of devolves into Rabbi Yaakov Beirav personally attacking Rabbi Levi ibn Chabib, right? Which is very terrible. And who does he give smicha to? Well, first of all, he gives it to Rabbi Yosef Karo, right? The author of the Shulchan Aruch. He gives it to another very significant rabbi in spot, Rabbi Moshe Mitrani, the Mabit. Hey, these rabbis give smicha to other rabbis as well. Okay, so there seems to be this kind of a trajectory of smicha being given, but ultimately what happens? It fizzles out. Okay. Both of them die soon afterwards. Nothing really comes of it. Nothing bigger comes of it. And I think the most fascinating element here is that Rabbi Yosef Karo himself in his Shulchan Aruch, he has smicha, right? He has smicha from Rabbi Yaakov Beirav. What does he write? A rapist is sentenced by three judges if the judges have been given smicha in the land of Israel. Today, v'ha'idna, right? And today, when we have no one with smicha, we excommunicate him until he makes restitution. Rabbi Yosef Karo himself says, we have no one with smicha today. There is no smicha. He himself has smicha. So it's a fascinating kind of fizzling out of this powerful idea, Why doesn't it work? So there are a lot of reasons you could give why it doesn't work, right? You could say, well, there's personal rivalry. Rabbi Yaakov Birav, Rabbi Levi Ibn Chabib, there's a personality clash, right? They don't agree. They don't agree with each other's opinions. They write against each other. There's conflicts between them. That could be one answer, right? In another minute, we're going to see there's also rivalry between Spot and Jerusalem. That could be another answer. But it seems that the real answer is how do you see halakha, right? Do you see halakha as activism, or do you see halakha as conservatism, right? If you're an activist like Rabbi Yaakov Beirav, you can say, can we bend halakha a little bit because it will bring about something greater, right? Rabbi Levi Ibn Chaviv says, no, our job is not to play God. Our job is God gave us halacha. We have to keep this halacha, and the rest of it is in God's hands, right? So it's an activist approach versus a conservative approach, which of course echoes throughout Jewish history. By the way, just interesting, in the beginning, in the early years of the State of Israel, there was a this controversy started up again at a much, much smaller level. But can we, now that we have come back to the land of Israel and we have our own state, our own commonwealth, can we now reinstitute smicha, which doesn't happen then either? Okay. But just to kind of have one last piece to it, right? We also have this idea of Tzfat versus Jerusalem, right? Last week we saw Tzfat, which is this kind of really unusual, new way of looking at the world and at God and at our role in redemption. And this idea of looking at the Galil, at the Galilee, as a place where the redemption is going to start, right? But you also have Jerusalem. And how can you have redemption without Jerusalem? So this is something I was going to do with you guys last week, and I brought it this week, right? We all know the Lecha Dodi prayer. Lecha Dodi prayer is one of the most famous things that comes out of 16th century Tzfat. It's written by Rabbi Shlomo Alkobetz. It becomes the song of Kabbalat Shabbat, right? Of our Friday night davening. Beautiful song, all about Shabbat and all about redemption, right? Lecha Dodi Likra Kala, let us go welcome the bride. And how Shabbat is also part of redemption. Mikdash Melech Ir Melucha, the sanctuary of the king, the royal city. Kumi Tzei Metocha, right? Come out of your overthrow, of your revolution. Rav lach shevet b'emek habacha. It's enough. You've had enough of dwelling in the sadness, and God is going to have compassion on you. Okay, beautiful, right? It's talking about redemption. Hitnari me'afar kumi. Shake off your dust. God is going to come. The Messiah is going to come. But if you look more carefully at the words, it is a very fascinating game that Rabbi Shlomo Alkobetz is playing here, right? This is the idea of a scholar named Rabbi, not Rabbi, Yair Paz. What he says is Rabbi Shlomo Alkobetz takes a lot of verses that are classic verses from the Bible, right? From the Nevi'im. And they're all about redemption, but they're also all about Jerusalem. And Rabbi Shlomo Alkobetz quotes these verses, but he leaves out Jerusalem, right? So if you say, V'hu yachmol alaychem, God's going to have compassion on you, that's an echo of a verse in Jeremiah. Ki mi yachmol alaych Yerushalayim, right? He leaves out Jerusalem. Who's going to have pity on you, Jerusalem? Hitnari me'afar kumi, shake off your dust. Comes from a verse in Isaiah, Inari me'afar kumi shvi Yerushalayim. No Yerushalayim. Liv shi bigdei tifartei chami, wear your clothes of glory, my nation. Well, actually, the original verse, Liv shi bigdei tifartei Yerushalayim. Right? Uri Uri Shir Daberi, rise and sing a song. Uri Uri Liv Shei Uzech Tzion. Again, Tzion. Hit ori kuba orech. Rise up, wake up, because your light has come. Hit ori kumi Yerushalayim. And everybody who's reading Lecha Dodi knows these verses, right? They're not unknown. People knew Tanakh in those days. And they can see what he's doing. And what he's doing is he's taking Jerusalem out of the equation. Not that Jerusalem's not important. Of course, Jerusalem's important. They're going to build the temple in Jerusalem. But Tzfat is going to be the place where it all starts, right? So redemption is going to begin in the north. It's going to begin in this holy community of Tzfat, which is working so hard to bring the redemption. And then ultimately it'll go to Jerusalem, right? So you do have this fascinating kind of civic rivalry between the two cities expressed, I think, very clearly. Once you see it, it's very hard to not to unsee it, right? Expressed very clearly in this Lechadodi, and certainly in this controversy. Okay, but we're going to go from Jerusalem to Hebron. Hebron is not part of either of our stories of the Smicha controversy or Dona Gracia, but it is very interesting because the Jewish presence in Hebron is reestablished very strongly in the 16th century. So you have Jews who have lived in Hebron, right? Jews live in Hebron, of course, in biblical times and Second Temple times. Obviously, during times like the Crusades, they are kicked out. They come back with the Mamluks, but a very important change takes place in the 16th century. You have somebody named Rabbi Malkiel Ashkenazi, who is a Jew who buys a piece of land that had been the place of the Karaites, and he moves the Jewish community to this new neighborhood. So you have, and I'll explain to you where it is in a moment. Okay, this is how this neighborhood looks today. It's right near the Avraham Avinu Synagogue. Today there's a lot of graffiti on it. This was an area that was lived in by Jews up until 1929, the 1929 riots, the Arabs, of course, the terrible massacre of Jews in Hebron, and then Jews essentially mostly leave Hebron, not completely, but mostly 1948. Of course, they leave completely because becomes part of Jordan. And only when they, and the Arabs take it over, they turn it into a marketplace. They desecrate the synagogue. We'll see the synagogue in a minute. And when the Jews come back after the Six-Day War, there's a lot of fighting back and forth to allow Jews to live here. Now there are Jews living in one part, not in the other part. This is a picture. This is actually a fascinating picture. This is from the 1930s, of Jews praying, not in Maratha Machpelah, not in the Cave of the Patriarchs, because from the Mamluk conquest, Jews are forbidden to enter the cave, okay, until 1967. They have to pray outside. They're allowed to ascend up to the seventh step and not beyond it. This is a photograph that was taken in 1936, which is really very fascinating because the assumption was that in 1929, with the terrible massacre, Jews essentially left Hebron, and we really don't hear about a Jewish community in Hebron, but it seems Jews did come back to pray at the cave or outside the cave, even in the 1930s. So Rabbi Malkiel Ashkenazi comes along and he moves the Jewish community, which had historically lived at the top of the hill, right, and buried at the bottom of the hill. Now it's flipped, right? And now the Jewish community lives at the bottom of the hill, right down the street from Maratha Machpelah, from the Cave of the Patriarchs. And they also purchased land at the top of the hill for a cemetery. We're going to see the cemetery in a minute. The synagogue that's built here, he makes a beautiful new synagogue that's called the Avraham Avinu Synagogue, right? Because here we are in Hebron, right? Avraham hangs out in Hebron. The picture on the left here is a picture from the early part of the 20th century. On the right is the renewed synagogue. In 1929, in the riots, the synagogue was utterly destroyed, desecrated, right? Terrible, terrible things done to it, and to the Torah scrolls. Very terrible. After 1967, there's a Jew, a Russian Jew, Ben Sion Tavger, a physicist, who decides he's going to take on as his project. First, he renews the Jewish cemetery in Hebron, and then he decides he's going to renew the synagogue. And he does. And today it's a beautiful synagogue, and you can go visit it. And that's the Avraham Avinu Synagogue. The cemetery, again, there's a flip. They buy land at the top of the hill, and this becomes the Jewish cemetery of Hebron. It's a very significant cemetery. A lot of important people who either lived in Hebron or wanted to be buried in Hebron are buried here. One of the very odd, unusual customs of Hebron is that in most cases, they did not write names on the gravestones. They had a pinkas, right? The Chevra Kadisha had a notebook where they wrote down where people were buried, but they did not have matzibot. They did not have names on the cemetery. In 1929, the cemetery is also terribly, terribly desecrated. But after the Six-Day War, because we had these very good records, the cemetery was able to be reconstructed, and we have some of the graves of some of the very important rabbis. This, on the right here, is the grave of Rabbi Eliyahu Vidas, who was one of the scholars of Hebron, and we have various others, more modern ones, right? Menucha Rachel, the Chabad Rebbetzin, the daughter of the Chabad, the first Chabad Rav. So a lot of interesting things in the Hebron Cemetery, but we are going to get to our story of Donna Gracia, who has become much more well known in recent years, but was really forgotten for a very, very long time. So I put you her life story, her timeline here, because it can be confusing. She lived in a lot of places. Why did she live in so many places? Because she was essentially on the run. Right? On the one hand, Donna Gracia's life is a classic story of the Muranos, of the Conversos. She's born into a family of secret Jews, right? In Portugal, remember the story, right? The Jews are expelled from Spain. Many Jews choose to go to Portugal, right next door. Similar language, very easy to get to. They can keep some of their business ties. And Portugal says, okay, Jews, you can come and you can live here freely as Jews, only to turn around 5 years later in 1497 and not even offer the Jews the option of expulsion, but to force them all to convert. So Dona Gracia, who is known at the time as Beatrice de Luna, is born into a family of conversos. She grows up as a good Christian, right? She's a good Catholic. And only when she turns 18, does she find out that number one, she's actually not a Catholic, she's a Jew. And number two, she's going to get married. Now, what did the conversos do? They would marry each other, right? The families would marry each other because that way you could keep your Judaism alive and you didn't, there was no danger of the secret getting out. So the families would marry each other and the age differences were not always so important. She marries her cousin, Francisco Mendez, who's quite a bit older than her. Dona Gracia Beatrice is a very smart young woman. Unfortunately, her husband recognizes that, and he teaches her the business. Now, Francisco is a very, very wealthy trader. We're going to talk about what he trades in a moment. So this is where her story is going to diverge from the classic Converso story. Yes, she is born into a family and she has her Judaism is secret. And yes, she's on the run from the Inquisition. And that's why she goes to live in all these places. But she also has an enormous fortune, right? Greater than almost anybody in Europe. So that allows her certain liberties that other Conversos did not have. She learns the business from her husband, which is very good because only 10 years after they're married, he dies and she takes over his part of the business. She manages to get out and get her family to Antwerp, where they still can't live openly as Jews, but the net of the Inquisition is a little bit less, tight around them than it is in Portugal. She takes her family with her sister, right? And then her sister marries her brother-in-law, okay? Her business partner, Diogo. So we have this very interesting, there's a lot of this family intertwining, okay? A few years later, Diogo dies as well. And rather than leaving his half of the business to his wife, he leaves it to his sister-in-law, which causes quite a bit of family conflict. Okay. But now Beatrice is unbelievably wealthy. Okay. There are sources that say that she has the greatest fleet of ships of anyone in Europe, not any Jew, not any woman, any person. Okay. Meanwhile, she has a daughter, Reina, and she has this huge fortune, and she's constantly in jeopardy because, first of all, everybody's after her daughter because her daughter is going to eventually inherit a huge fortune. Of course, she doesn't want to marry her daughter to a Christian. Second, it would be very good for the Inquisition if they could catch her because then the money would go to them. So everybody's watching her all the time. Things get too hot for her in Antwerp. She picks herself up and her family. They move to Venice. Okay. Ultimately, she and her sister have a falling out. She almost is she's thrown into prison, but she eventually gets out. And eventually they move to Ferrara, where Jews are allowed to live freely, and she finally can live openly as a Jew. She changes her name. She takes this new name, Gracia or Chana, right? Means the same thing, Gracia Nasi, as opposed to Beatrice Mendez. And eventually she gets out of Europe altogether. She goes to Istanbul. And then we're going to see what her story is there, where she really exercises her power in two different things. One is in the Ancona affair, and the other is in leasing Tiberias from the Sultan. And then she ultimately dies in Istanbul, 1569. Okay, so I hope we've got all our places straight, right? Portugal, Antwerp, Venice, Ferrara, Istanbul, quite a whirlwind life in less than 60 years. The fortune that the Mendez family makes is from trade, but specifically from trade in pepper. Okay. Pepper and spices in general are a very, very hot commodity in Europe. Okay. Remember Columbus goes looking for a new route, a new spice route. They're a very hot commodity in Europe. They're not grown in Europe. They're grown in India. And you have to be able to get them. And there's only a very few routes. And this is what encourages the age of exploration, because they want to get a new route to get to India. Whoever is unmuted, mute themselves, please. Maxine, mute people. Thank you. So pepper is this very important commodity. And if you can bring it in and you have suppliers and you have ships, you can make a lot of money. So what does Dona Gracia do? She builds up her husband's business, but she also does something fascinating. We're finding out more and more about this in the last few decades. She has this enormous fleet of ships that essentially can travel freely from the area of the Ottoman Empire to Europe and back. And what does she do? She takes Jews. She creates an underground railroad where she brings these conversos to freedom. She takes them from Spain and from Portugal, and she often will bring them kind of via London or the Netherlands and ultimately on to Turkey, onto the Ottoman Empire, and onto freedom. And this is something where she really is able to save the lives of thousands of Jews. But again, she's always on the run. There's always this suspicion. There's always this desire for her money. Once she gets to Ferrara, okay, first of all, she's in Venice, as we said. She has issues with her sister. Her sister is not excited about all this secret Jew stuff and saving Jews. She doesn't think about this at all. And eventually they have such a falling out that she denounces her sister to the Inquisition. But Dona Gracia has enough connections, and ultimately she makes a very important connection with the Sultan in Turkey, with Sultan Suleiman. And that eventually saves her, and she gets out of prison. She goes to Ferrara, where she, as we said, she's able to live openly as a Jew. She becomes very involved not only in saving Jews and getting them out, but in philanthropy, in developing kind of publishing and Jewish books and saving Jews all over. And one of the most famous books that she puts out is this Ferrara Bible, right? And as you can see on the front, there's a fascinating drawing here, right? It's a Bible. Why would you have this drawing? You have a drawing of ships, ships at sea and sea monsters, perhaps connected to Dona Gracia and her fleet of ships, right? Very, very interesting. And eventually she heads out of Europe altogether. She goes to Istanbul, where she's basically received as a queen by the Jewish community. This is a picture, not a very good picture, I apologize, of the Ahrida synagogue in Turkey. This is a synagogue from this time period. And she is received royally. The Sultan, in deference to the fact that she's got oodles of money, he is willing to receive her, even though she's a woman, right? She has to go veiled, but he's still willing to receive her. And she just becomes somebody who's just essentially the queen of the Jewish community. And then we have this fascinating story, which ultimately is a failure, for Dona Gracia, but it's one of these stories, as is the next story that we're going to tell, of what if, right? How could things have changed? So Ancona, we'll come back to this picture in a minute, but I want us to understand where we are, right? Ancona, here it is, on the coast of Italy. Okay. Very important port city. Okay. We'll come back. And it has a rival port. I don't know if you guys can see the yellow. Let's just make it nice and black. Okay. Here's Ancona, or red, and it has a rival port slightly north called Pesaro. Okay, now what we know about the Jews of Italy is that each city-state essentially has its own ruler, right? Usually a duke. And some cities are very friendly to the Jews, some cities are not. Some places you can live openly as a Jew, some places you cannot. In Ancona, there is a Jewish community. Jews are allowed to live openly, but conversos, right, who are not always so accepted by the local Jewish community, right, the ones who continue living secretly, living as Christians and secretly as Jews, the Inquisition is still after them, right? The Inquisition can't really do anything to Jews, but they can do things to Christians who are heretics, which is essentially what the conversos are. So there's a group of conversos, 25 of them, 24 men and one woman, who are imprisoned by the Pope in Ancona, and the Pope is going to burn them at the stake. He wants them to renounce their Judaism. They refuse to renounce their Judaism, and Donna Gracia decides that she is going to intervene, right? So just the pictures that you have here, right? This is the Jewish cemetery in Ancona, the remains of the Jewish cemetery. This is a picture of an auto da fe, right? These terrible, terrible things where the Inquisition would burn people alive. And Donna Gracia hears about this. Now remember, this is a woman with enormous economic power. She's got this huge fleet of ships. And if she says, "I am not sending my ships through the port in Ancona. I am going to boycott this port unless you release these Jews," that could really have an effect. And she decides that that's what she wants to do. But of course, this is the 16th century. She's a woman. She needs the support of the rabbis. And the Jewish world is split, right? And we have our classic question: is this good for the Jews? Is this bad for the Jews? Right? Very interventionist, not so different, a very different style, but not so different from the story of the Smicha controversy. Can we use our economic power? Is this a legitimate way for Jews to act? What is the downside? Well, there is a Jewish community in Ancona which is living relatively safely. Maybe there'll be a backlash against them, right? Maybe the Pope will punish them because we're using our economic power. Maybe the Jews of Pesaro will then benefit, right? Maybe that's a good thing. It's back and forth, right? There's not one view in the Jewish world. There are different opinions. And ultimately the whole thing fails. It fails because the Jews refuse to agree. And I think part of that is not only because they're worried about repercussions, but because this is not a way that Jews have ever acted, right? Jews intervene kind of behind the scenes. You have a very wealthy guy who can influence the Duke or influence the King. But to go out and to say, "We're going to have a boycott, we're going to act with this real economic power and almost violence," we're not so quick to do that, right? But Donna Gracia is ready to do it. And that's when she gets to her very groundbreaking idea, right? Here's this woman who's been essentially on the run her entire life. Okay? She finally escapes to freedom. She helps hundreds, probably thousands of others to escape to freedom. But she understands that this is not a long-term solution. And then she, in the 1560s, says, "What's the long-term solution? An autonomous Jewish state." Right? That's unbelievable. She comes up with this idea more than 300 years before Theodor Herzl, before Leo Pinsker, before the Chovev HaTzion. She says we need to have an independent and autonomous Jewish state where Jews can live free from persecution. Now, in those days, it worked a little bit differently than it did in the 19th and the 20th century. What does she do? She goes to the Sultan and she says, "Listen, I will give you X amount of money to lease the city of Tiberias from you." Why Tiberias? It's a city that needs to be economically built up. She sees it as a little bit of a blank slate. I can make it, grow back, and it'll be great, and you'll get all the tax benefits. And the Sultan doesn't care so much what she's going to do. She talks about money. He's happy to take the money. He takes the money, and she and her nephew, who is also her son-in-law, remember, complicated family relationship, Don Yosef Nasi. decide they're going to build it. She decides she's going to build herself a home there. And they start with all these plans and then nothing, right? And then nothing because she dies. She's already not a young woman anymore. Don Yosef, her nephew who inherits her fortune, is not as skilled as her. And the whole plan kind of falls apart. But it's a fascinating thing. Like, what if there had been even a tiny Jewish state in the 16th century, right? How would that have changed Jewish history? And the fact that she, as a woman, as a converso, growing up in this very circumscribed world, that she comes up with these audacious ideas, probably because she's such a wealthy woman and she's a very smart woman and she's a businesswoman and she's used to wielding her power. And she can think in a very different way than other Jews think about. She's forgotten for a long time. In the 1940s, the historian Cecil Roth writes about her. And in the past, I would say 15, 20 years, there's been an explosion of interest in Dona Gracia. There are novels about her, historical novels. There's all kinds of interest in teaching her story to bat mitzvah girls. And the most interesting place is this hotel in Tveria. There's a businessman in Tveria who was fascinated by the story of Dona Gracia, and he took over an old dilapidated hotel, and he turned it into, it's still a hotel, but it's also a museum about her life. And the whole first floor is each room is decorated in the style of one of the places where she lived, right? So there's a Venetian room and there's a Lisbon room. And the center in the lobby is the Istanbul room, where the best part is that you can dress up in period costume and it's a fascinating place. So that's Dona Gracia. So let's end with this question. Did Sephardic Jews change the world? Right? It's a good question for Sephardim. This would make them very happy. So did Sephardic Jews change the world? Ultimately, a lot of these ideas do not actually happen, right? It's a little too early. It's pre-modern. We're not modern yet, but there is a new way of looking at the world. This, by the way, is a picture of the beautiful Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai synagogue in Jerusalem, one of the four Sephardic synagogues that become the synagogues of Jerusalem in the late 16th century. We have some new ways of looking at the world, right? More activists. We don't necessarily have to wait for the Messiah. We can actually try to bring the Messiah ourselves. Okay. They have this idea of messianism that we're going to see next time with Shabtai Tzvi, which is going to be taking the entire Jewish world by storm, as well as something we didn't talk about so much, but is very important. Sephardic Jews really dominate. They spread their way of praying. They spread their customs all over the Ottoman Empire, in a way that really changes the Jewry of the Ottoman Empire forever. So there are a lot of things that Sephardic Jews do that really do change a lot of how we perceive the world. So let's see. Wow, I have an entire 2 minutes to take questions. That's so unusual. Okay, so let's see what questions we have. If there was no smicha, how do we have rabbinic authority? So we do have rabbinic authority. It's just not the smicha that is considered enough for the Sanhedrin. A rabbi is still a rabbi. A rabbi still gets smicha, but it's not the same as in the time of the Sanhedrin, and they don't have the same authorities as they had in the time of the Sanhedrin. There was a more recent attempt to renew the Sanhedrin in the early 2000s. Yes, I recall that vaguely. Yes, but we are so divided that there is just no way that it could have ever happened, right? And that's exactly what you're writing here, Saul. Rav Kook died in 1935, and they prayed at the Cave of Machpelah just before his death. Ah, very nice. Thank you. Thank you, Irene. So that makes sense, right? That fits what we're saying. What prevents the Sultan from merely taking Dona Gracia's money? The Sultan is not a criminal. He wants to do business with her. He wants to take a lot of taxes from her. He can get rich, and Dona Gracia can get rich too. He's not worried about that. Ferrara is in Italy, and what happens to Dona Gracia's fortune? That's a great question, right? We don't really know. Ultimately, Don Yosef, her nephew, is not particularly successful, and he probably just squanders it, right? It probably just kind of falls apart. It's a lot easier to lose a fortune than to make a fortune. Let's put it that way. Why doesn't Dona Gracia purchase Tveria? More or less, she does, right? She leases it, but it's close enough to being purchased. So a good biography. So there, I have to say, I'm embarrassed to say, but there's a lot of good historical fiction that I I know better than I know a good biography. The classic old biography is Cecil Roth, but there are newer ones that are based on more modern research. Google Dona Gracia, there's a lot out there. She has become like really just this very popular figure. But if you want to read good historical fiction that's really based in reality, that's based in history, there's a book by Naomi Regan called The Ghost of Juana Mendez. And it has like a modern part. You can skip that part, but the old part is very interesting. But in terms of whose biographies are good, I have to say I don't have somebody at the tip of my tongue. Anybody else? Good questions, questions, comments. Mark David Baer is writing a fair amount of research on Jews in the Ottoman Empire. Very possible, but does he write about Dona Gracia? That we do not know. But look him up, Mark David Baer. Thank you, Murray. Okay. Anyone else have questions? So next week, first of all, happy Hanukkah. Next week we are having class like usual. I said to Rabbi Kalman, are we skipping classes? No, Hanukkah is more Torah, not less Torah. So Murray says he does write about Dona Gracia. Thank you. So we are having class. It is our final class for this series, and it's about Chabtai Tzvi. So stay tuned.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Looking forward to
seeing
you again.
Thank you.
Thank you. Excellent class.
Wonderful. Thank you, everyone. Happy Thanksgiving.